Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary on this Tuesday morning. Sorry we're running a little late. The traffic was a little bit heavier than I anticipated. Today we have a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2545B, as in boy. And then we have a number of work sessions that we may be working some of the bills today. Some of the paperwork's not here, and so we'll be carrying some of those over, but we're going to play them by ear because we anticipate we may get some of the paperwork in while we're here. So with that, we'll start with the public hearing on House Bill 2545B. And Josh, why don't you go ahead and give us an overview on that one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2545B expands the ability of law enforcement to use deception detection devices other than polygraphs. The bill broadens the officials who may use these devices to include corrections officers and parole and probation officers, while authorizing the use of the devices in supervising offenders and investigating misconduct in a correctional facility. Finally, the bill also prohibits the use of these devices as a condition of employment.
All right, so looks like we have five people, and you see the Niels Harris is supposed to be a call-in. Okay, and did we have a time frame for when we're supposed to do that?
No.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and bring up Robert Gross, and there she is. All right, Jody, why don't you go ahead and get us started, then we'll bring up the other two, because I'm going to let you get back to work.
They can come too if they want. I'm fine.
Okay, I didn't know what your schedule was.
I'll go ahead, though, and start if that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is State Representative Jody Hack, and I have the pleasure of bringing before you House Bill 2545, and I just want to say thank you so much for your willingness to hear this piece of legislation. It's also known as the Deception Detection Examination Bill. Let me start by saying that the polygraph statute was written into law in 1975. Modern technology has significantly advanced over the last 42 years. The way the statute was written did not consider the technological advancements in deception detection. House Bill 2545B allows correction officers, parole and probation officers, or police officers to use certain deception detection instruments in course of official duties while conducting investigation or providing community protection. These detection instruments are currently prohibited because of the 1975 polygraph statute language. We spoke with the Department of Corrections, Parole and Probation, and the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs before drafting the language to ensure there would be no opposition. This is new technology that needs to be vetted, and we are simply starting the discussion. Senator Prezansky and I had some lengthy discussion. We did have some opportunity on the House side to look at the scientific evidence, and we had a little more opportunity to vet this out than you all have on the Senate side. So I understand that we're probably going to need to take some more time in the interim to work through a few of the issues with this. This is nothing to take lightly, so I respect that and understand that. I also spoke with Officer Scott, I'm gonna butcher his last name, Sedesar, I think is how he says it, Sedesar, of the American Association of Police Polygraphers, who's shared some concerns with me, and I look forward to working with him as we work through some of those issues. So with that said, I'll turn it over to some of these other folks. But again, Chair, I appreciate your willingness to take the time to hold the public hearing and look forward to working with all of you and hopefully with the joint committee to vet this out and learn the opportunity to check into the sciences and be able to advance and take the opportunity to do that. So thank you again for your willingness to do that. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Let's first ask if there's any questions for Representative Hack. All right, gentlemen, before we take your testimony, I do want to go ahead and put on the record, as Representative Hack said, she and I did have an opportunity this last week to talk on the merits of the bill. This bill was referred to our committee on the last day that it could be referred to our committee prior to it needing to be actually posted. So we went and posted for both a public hearing and work session based on my directions, with the understanding that at this point we were planning on, I'm planning on having the public hearing. We will not have a work session on this bill today. As Representative Hack said, this is a new and different area of that we as a state have not looked at before. And as most of you know that have been with judiciary, we will be taking the measured time through the interim with the Joint Committee to be looking at this and other issues that need to take a little bit more vetting instead of just moving something through without having the framework in, that's in place to support this type of legislation. With that, gentlemen, I have Robert Gross, and I believe it's Robert, is it Johnson?
Peter Shannon.
Peter Shannon.
Okay, I guess I could see that with those lines through there.
Southpaw, backhanded.
Yeah, I'm backhanded too, but that one, I got Shannon. Okay, so gentlemen, I'll just say Roberts. Whoever would like to start, give us your first name or your last name and your testimony, please.
Okay, thank you very much. And Chair Przanski and Senators, I really do appreciate the opportunity for you to let us come bring this technology to you. My name is Robert Gross. I retired from Lane County Sheriff's Office about 10 years ago after 27 years of service. I've known Peter Shannon and his work with sex offender treatment clients for 25 years. And during that time, the polygraph had been an essential part of making sure that the people who were in treatment were in program compliance, weren't doing things that were unreported, and somehow skating through treatment and remaining dangerous before they're reunited with their families or back into the community. So to that end, I went and obtained the training necessary to have an interim polygraph license in the state of Oregon. I was conducting polygraphs. And in a training session up in Washington State, came across the iDetect technology. I was really impressed. The reason for that was that it was another verification, totally separate from polygraph, to make sure that sex offenders in treatment, for example, were not having hidden social network accounts, weren't leaving the county, or were doing things that were unreported or uncaught. That's one of the uses of polygraph, to see if you're lying to your treatment provider or parole and probation officer during treatment, and a way to hold you accountable. This was a totally new technology that had been developed since polygraph was developed almost 100 years ago. But the statute didn't, Oregon statute didn't allow for this type of equipment, and that's why I'm here before you today. It's much like if you get a TB test on your arm, right, and it turns positive, you would like not to just have that TB test again on your arm. You want to have a chest X-ray. You want another type of technology to verify that this is accurate. That's what iDetect can do. It is as accurate as the best administered polygraph, yet it takes out a lot of the issues that have plagued polygraph. The interaction between the polygrapher and the person taking the exam, how the question sets are constructed, the nervousness of people, all the equipment hooked up, but that's so unnatural. This, if in the future we have a chance to demonstrate the technology to you, is simply what you are doing right now. You're sitting before your computer, you have a mouse, you're reading questions, and you are saying true or false. During a 30-minute test, there are 90,000 samples of your eye movement taken by an infrared camera. That data is sent through the cloud, is scored by a computer algorithm. It's not subjectively scored by any human being. It's math. That 90,000 data points is scored and gives you a report of being credible or not. There's no interaction between the person. There's no bias. There's no wires hooked up. It's something that kids do, you do, I do every day. And so the stress and the awkwardness of taking an exam is eliminated. And it's looking at other markers. Polygraph looks at what your heart rate goes up or down, your blood pressure, whether your skin conducts electricity well. All those are markers of polygraph. iDetect has none of those. All it cares about is this. If I say to you, what's 2 times 15? You'll say 30. It takes very little thought. If I say to you, what's 15 times 17? Well, you'll give me the answer, but it will take a little bit of thought. And that's what's being measured. That extra cognitive load registers in eye dilation, constriction, reading patterns, that sort of thing. That's what's being measured. It doesn't matter if you're nervous or not. It's what part of your brain is engaged to answer the question. You cannot control this. Thus far, There are no countermeasures that have been found that are effective against this exam. It's 300 plus questions in half an hour that you answer, just sitting in front of a computer. And that data, you will score it time after time after time after time. It'll come out exactly the same because it's not interpreted by a human being. It's math. And so it's a much more fair test. When I was doing polygraph, I would meet with other polygraphers and we would practice different charts. What do you see in this chart? Would you score it this way? Would you not score it this way? It's subjective. That's why it takes a year of 200 exams to learn that skill to be consistent with other polygraph examiners. That, I believe, is one of Mr. Sadezar's complaints, that how do you learn this without all this training? It's done the same way that you go get an ultrasound. The ultrasound tech takes the reading, sends it to the doctor. They know how to use the piece of equipment. They don't interpret the data. They don't monkey with the data. They don't do any of that. It's all done automatically. It takes the human bias out of it. And it's replicable time after time after time. So what I would ask is that if this seems interesting to you, could we please show you this technology, give you more information about this technology? This would be a valuable tool, especially for treatment providers like Mr. Shannon, who I've worked with, who work closely with parole and probation officers who have enormous caseloads and don't have time to meet with their clients who they're supervising for sex crimes, for example, and they want to reunify with their family. They want permission to go into the community. They want permission for passes. They want permission for this. They need supervision levels lowered over time. If you have additional data, additional exams that can verify that they're truthful, that they're in program compliance, that they're not lying to you about being on social media, they don't have hidden accounts, they're not using drugs that you don't catch because they know a drug test coming up, so they just clean themselves up before they take the drug test. If you can know these things to show that they are really in compliance with treatment, then the probation officer who's really in charge of saying, we're going to put this guy back out in the community, has more tools. His decision will be higher quality. I think victims will be safer from people who are conning their way through any sort of treatment. That's the sort of thing I really find valuable. That's why I went back to polygraph school, is I wanted to do polygraphs because I saw they were essential. When I saw this technology, that this also would be valuable. It would really enhance the quality of the decision-making for reunification, for public access to people who are offenders, for example. So what I'm asking also is that you would reconsider just the language of it, because 2545B would make this, the way it's written, unavailable to treatment providers who really have the lion's share of the contact and interaction with offenders and who work closely with parole and probation officers to make recommendations. Yeah, he's in compliance with treatment. Go ahead and allow for this pass. Go ahead and allow for this family contact, that sort of thing. The decision quality would be better because it's more thoroughly vetted. The person is much more thoroughly vetted. Statistically, if you combine an iDetect test and a polygraph test and you get the same result, you can have almost a 98% certainty that your decision is accurate. That's what the math is when you combine the two technologies. So to allow, to amend the measure or consider doing it so that it could be somehow utilized by treatment providers who really work hand in hand with parole and probation to make sure that the decisions the probation officer is making are accurate and correct. That's what I really would like you to consider broadening a little bit the language to allow for. It's a huge problem, and treatment is necessary, but treatment has to be effective. And if treatment can't be verified as being on target and in compliance, then it's wasted time, and you have to begin again. And it doesn't serve the public well either. So, Mr. Sadezar, does raise concerns, and they're valid, and I understand them. But because I understand both technology, I am very, very comfortable with his concerns. And I think if he had more exposure to iDetect, he would be very comfortable too. The past president of the American Polygraph Association uses iDetect now. There are several people who are past and present members of the American Polygraph Association who are partners with Converis for the equipment to come forward. Lafayette, who's one of the major manufacturers and sellers of deception detection equipment in the United States, now offers iDetect as an alternative technology. They sell it. They see the merit in it. And so I just ask, I thank you for your time. I ask you to consider it. In my opinion, it's a valuable tool, and I have a vested interest in this. My wife, for 25 years, has been a trauma therapist, putting together the kids that this stuff has ruined. I'm done.
Okay. I'd like to, can I chime back in, Chair?
Sure.
For the record, State Representative Jody Hack, I just have to say I want to be very clear on one thing. I have no desire in, and forgive me, Bob, but for some very personal reasons, in rehabilitating a sex offender, though. And I have to say I did not know that this would be used at the time. I can't do it.
Take your time. No.
Thank you.
Could I address one more time?
No. Why don't we do this? Why don't we just take a quick break here? I'm going to ask Dr. Shannon to go ahead and give us his testimony, and we'll pick up on Q&A from there.
Thank you, sir.
Much of Chair Przanski and Senators, thank you for allowing us to testify. I'm actually pretty excited about this from a clinical perspective, and much of what I have to say will be redundant with what my good friend and colleague, Mr. Gross, has said, so I will try to expedite this so as to not bore you too much with repetition, but allow me to introduce myself. My background, I'm a licensed professional counselor. I was in the first wave of licensed professional counselors in 19...
Dr. Shannon, I'm going to ask you to put your name on the record again. I think you did it, but I want to make
sure. I'm sorry, Peter Thompson Shannon.
All right, thank you.
Okay. I was in the first wave in the early 1900s of being a licensed professional counselor in the state of Oregon. I'm a founding member of the Association for Treatment of Sexual Abusers, ATSA. We founded the program, the professional organization, in 1988. It's now approaching a membership of 3,000 internationally. The home base is in Beaverton. I have 130,000 clinical hours working with sex offenders. We currently have approximately 70 offenders in our treatment program. I've worked with approximately 1,400 offenders in my life, 33 years. I'm also one of only 72 clinical certified sex offender providers in the state through the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, the Sex Offender Treatment Board. A lot of our work we do civil work as well in terms of divorce cases, custody, assessments, sexual safety assessments for DHS, CPS. But mostly my experience has been working with sex offenders. Mr. Gross mentioned that, in essence, it's a metaphor, we are the eyes in the community of parole and probation. We work far more closely with our clients than parole and probation officers do, simply because of the nature of our work and simply also because of the fact that their caseloads are even more horrendous than ours. The average probation officer, as far as I'm aware, has at least 75 to 100 clients that they're working with in the particular areas that they're supervising. So we are seeing our people on a daily basis. We work closely with parole and probation, interchanging phone calls almost daily. We do quarterly progress reports back and forth between parole and probation and treatment providers in Lane County anyway, and I assume that actually a good chunk of the state does the same thing. So we have more hands-on contact with our population. And because of that, I think we have the familiarity. I certainly do, as probably one of the senior therapists on the West Coast, with the amount of time that I've put in. The technology that Mr. Gross is talking about would be a valuable resource for treatment providers to have, because what it does is it's expeditious, it's accurate, it's useful, and it's convenient. We can test people in our office. We can make decisions much quicker rather than to wait for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks for polygraph examiners who oftentimes are also equally swamped. This is new technology that is user-friendly. It's extremely easy to utilize. It's extremely easy to proctor. I myself have taken the test. Mr. Gross and I have been involved with approximately 15 demonstration exams. All 15, mine included, were the deception was successfully detected in the protocol. And it's the science behind it is solid, using infrared cameras that are located on the bottom left and right sides of the monitor screen. They lock into the pupils. They record the oscillation frequency changes between dilation and contraction of pupils. And they do that, as Mr. Gross said, at a rate of 90,000 frames in the test period of about 30 minutes. It also measures what we call cognitive load. That is the amount of prefrontal cortex right here in the front of the brain that has to do with concentration, focus, and attention and decision making. That is, how intense and how long and how difficult is it for me to tell the truth or to fabricate deception and maintain a steady pattern of that deception? It's much easier to tell the truth because you know what the truth is and you don't have to remember what the story was. Logic and common sense. It's much more difficult to remember what the lie is and then periodically throughout the test reiterate the same response set. So the two together produce very, very useful results. Because it's much quicker, it's also much less expensive. Let me also say that in my experience professionally, we've done between 2,000 to 2,500 polygraph examinations. In our office, we've used polygraph examiners for the last 30 years, utilized, I should say, and will continue to do so. This is not a position, this is not a protocol or a therapeutic approach that is against polygraph examinations. We use them in consort. We think, as Mr. Gross said, the best combination of results for accuracy purposes would be to combine polygraph examinations with the ocular motor test for deception results, and you'd have almost an ironclad position, which is extremely useful when it comes to things like considering sanctions for noncompliance for parole and probation, standards of community safety, conditions of probation, following treatment program requirements. We have a 4-page contract that our gentlemen that we work with have to sign that absolutely structures their entire life in terms of do's and don'ts. Periodically, we want to test to see if they're in or out of compliance. That has a lot to do with public safety, particularly if we're talking about things like acting out in the community with partners that you're not involved with, i.e. prostitutes, et cetera, friends with benefits, use of pornography, use of illicit substances, alcohol abuse if they have a no alcohol condition. So we want to know as soon as possible whether or not they're in compliance when we have a suspicion or not. If we have that equipment in our office, we can get to it right away. And that's important for community safety.
Dr. Chan, I'm going to ask you to wrap up so we can do some Q&A. I've got three other people that need to testify.
Okay. I think that's as much as I need to say.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start off with the questions first. Senator Lithicum, I think you had your hand up first, then Senator Manning second.
Just in terms of reviewing this, I can't remember where this first came into discussion, Chair. It may have been in conversations here, whatever. But as I looked around, I saw an 85% accuracy rate.
Yes.
And that means 15% failure rate. And I'm curious, the discussion you made it sound like this is perfect, and in terms of negating that 15% failure rate, is this only to be used in conjunction with other deception validation tests?
It can be used as a standalone exam. It can be used as a precursor to also incorporate polygraphy if necessary. But the two tests together eliminate that 15% for the most part. The two tests stand alone are about 85% accurate when the protocol is followed. When the interaction between the polygraph examiner and the individual who's taking the exam is copacetic and all the protocols followed, about 85% roughly. The same is true with ocular motor. If you put the two tests together and you can test the subject in sequence, literally in different times of the day or in the next day, then you have approximately 98% accuracy rate. The test is two different systems. You have the eyes, you have the occipital lobe of the brain, and you have the prefrontal cortex. That's separate from the limbic system, which is the thalamus, the hypothalamus, the adrenal glands, the pituitary gland, and so forth. That's what polygraph measures. Polygraph measures arousal to anxiety based on the perception of fear. It's a hormonal reaction. The ocular motor test measures the mechanics of eye dilation or contraction. They're two entirely separate systems. They're totally unrelated in terms of neurophysiology. So they're getting at the same issue. Is this person telling the truth or not? Using two different corroborating systems. It's excellent. I'm excited about this, and as a treatment provider, I can't tell you how useful this would be. In fact, I can tell you it will be incredibly helpful for us. And I'm on the board of directors for Sponsors Incorporated. We use it with a lot of the clients that that are housed at Sponsors that are also in our treatment program as well.
Follow up?
No.
Senator Manning.
Real quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. How many other states have this particular technology in their statute?
33.
Okay, the other question is that you just indicated that you're already using this. Why should we put this in statute when you're already using this technology?
We're not using it.
We can't.
We're doing demonstration tests.
Okay, I thought I heard you say something that sponsors that you're using this.
We will be. If I indicated that was a miscommunication on my part. We are using polygraph examinations with clients at Sponsors all the time, but we would add this to that protocol as well.
Thank you.
All right, I guess for either one of you, false positives, tell me about those things happening if they do happen.
Okay. Neil Harris is representative from Converis. I can get you.
Well, Mr. Harris is scheduled to give testimony, so I'm going to be calling him.
He would be the one to ask for that. He could give you the up-to-date information about some of the 85%. Some of those exams that don't count would be what's required in an eye detect test. Basically, is that a person's head be still enough to where their eyes are within a window where the cameras are taking good data. Now, if the person moves a lot, like this, where the data loses track every now and then, there won't be enough data to give a score. That will be a non-scoring test. That's in that 15%. That typically is about the only reason is lack of data acquisition, because it's, like I said, it's not interpretation, it's math. Either there was enough data collected or not. And if there was, a score can be made. But if not, then it falls into the non-testable, inconclusive, that sort of thing, which is a part of that 15%, which Mr. Harris can speak to much better than I can.
All right. Any other questions at this point, Senator Lithicum?
Maybe I'll save it for Mr. Harris.
Okay. That's who we're going to call up next. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming up, if you'll step back. Derry, I got a note that you wanted to conclude Representative Hack's testimony. I'm not sure what else she had. I had the impression she'd complete it, but if you'd like to add a few more.
Yeah, Derry Breeden, Eugene, Oregon, Chief of Staff for Representative Hack, House District 19. She just wanted to leave it for the record that she did not want to produce any legislation whatsoever that could ever be used to support sex offenders, and she wanted to make that clear on the record that she does not support sex offenders and wants it to be known on the record for this bill during this testimony.
Well, we appreciate that, but I assume that she maybe not would agree or not just maybe she wouldn't agree. You know, our job is trying to, quote-unquote, rehabilitate, hold people accountable, and try to keep from re-victimization or new victimization from occurring. And if that means that somehow we can actually get someone to modify their behavior where that doesn't happen, I'd assume she, as well as all of us, would want that to occur.
Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and call Mr. Harris at this point. And
thank you for calling Converse. For English, press 1. Para español. Thank you for calling Converse, the leader in deception detection. If you know your party's extension, dial it now.
This is Neil.
Mr. Harris, this is Floyd Przonski, State Senator from Oregon. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you, Floyd?
I'm doing wonderful. I understand that you were given notice that we were going to ask you to give some testimony today. We're in the judiciary room now. I'm not sure if you've been tracking us online or not.
I have not. I did not know the web address. Could you give me that web address, and I'll track the proceedings after my testimony is given?
Yeah, it's the Oregon Legislative Information System, and the way to find it is, let's see, that would be the... we changed our ad. Yeah, if you Google it for Oregon Legislative Information Systems, that's the easiest way. So,
I'm on there now. Meetings today.
Meetings today. There's a little camera.
Meetings.
Got it.
Yep.
Okay, you should be pulling us up. If you go there, there's a way to tag into the live stream at this point.
Yeah, little camera icon. Nice to put a... I need to freshen up my player, but that's okay.
All right, so I have you live now in committee, and what I'd like for to do is ask you to give us your name for the record, and then my understanding is you're going to give us some of the backdrop and technical information regarding iDetect.
Sure. My name is Neil Harris.
All right, Mr. Harris, why don't you go proceed with whatever testimony you wanted to provide to us.
Great. Would you like me to start with my prepared statements that I believe you should have a copy of?
If it's already been submitted to us and if it's been posted, there's no need for it to be read into the record since it's already part of the record.
Oh, okay. So from my... from my written testimony, the heart of the issue is whether or not the legislature of Oregon wants to allow the agencies that are detecting deception or tasked with community supervision to have access to an additional tool. I don't see anything in the in House Bill 2545 that would require it or mandate it, and I don't see anything in this bill that would in any way negatively impact what has been done currently. It's just giving them the ability to look at alternative technologies that that are newer to assist them in doing their job. I think that's the core of the bill.
All right. So, Mr. Harris, what we are planning on doing with this bill is we're taking testimony today. I've already placed on the record that we will not be moving the bill, meaning the bill will not be advancing at this time, because since it is was just filed with the committee on the last day that it could be filed before it had to be posted for a public hearing and work session, I've chosen as the chair to basically have the introduction through this public hearing, but we will have through our interim process more detailed review and presentations. With that said,
I will say that I've looked here. It looks like your preliminary statement has not been posted yet. So if you can make certain that you submit it so it will become part of the record, that would be great. One of the questions that was asked earlier was regarding false positives on the iDetect. Can you talk to us a little bit about how a false positive can occur if it does, in fact, occur?
Yeah, well, yes, they do occur. In fact, in any form of deception detection, it isn't perfect science. But it is, false positives occur in all forms of deception detection. It is very important that the committee recognize that we are merely providing an additional tool to be used by law enforcement, corrections, and treatment providers as a data point. We do not advocate that that any individual's life is significantly impacted or negatively impacted by the mere test result from one test. That would be, in our opinion, very inappropriate. The goal of these tools, they have been scientifically validated at 86% to detect deception on the test topics that are being tested. Now, the next step in the process would be to have a corrections officer, probation and parole officer, or treatment provider sit down and have a conversation with the examinee and express to them how they did on their test and ask if they'd like to offer any additional information that might clarify why they were markers of deception when they were responding to the test questions.
Okay.
But I think it's a very, very important point is that the field of deception detection scientifically, there are no absolutes. There is no perfection. And one area where what we really try to emphasize is the advantage of this type of test is it eliminates all of the human error that creeps into alternative forms of deception detection. Humans make mistakes, and when you are administering a test where it is the human can have a wide variability in training, in temperament, in bias, in judgment, and we remove the subjectivity from the testing process. This is just straight data coming in from a sensor and applying algorithms that have been scientifically validated to that data. So we eliminate all the errors that are prone in alternative forms of testing. I don't want to get too long-winded, but one area where the American Polygraph Association and past presidents of the American Polygraph Association have expressed a significant amount of concern is in the area of sex offender maintenance. There is a group of people called, they call it the containment model, where you'll have a polygraph examiner, a corrections officer, and a treatment provider that are all involved in the maintenance of a sex offender. What invariably happens is a treatment provider or a corrections officer that aren't well-versed in polygraph technology will say, well, ask him this or ask her this. And the questions are not framed in a way that they are fair to the examinee. They tend to take the form of, well, ask them if they've ever done this or if they've ever done that. And in polygraph science, that is, it reduces the accuracy of a test result when it is an open-ended fishing expedition. But that is very, very common in sex offender testing. A past APA president has testified that upwards of 70% of the sex offender management polygraph testing is done improperly. And, you know, our technology we have designed to be fair. When you are merely looking at sensor data and interpreting that data with algorithms that have been scientifically validated, the examinee has a much fairer chance of passing the test than if there is a bias in the from the examiner, because they potentially have biased against a certain type of criminal. Does that make sense?
It does. And what I'm going to ask, Mr. Harris, if you can kind of wrap up, I want to open up for questions. I have another two people that need to testify on this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to make some, I guess, a summation, and then I'm going to open up for questions.
I guess my summation would be the inventors of the computerized polygraph algorithms have tried now for close to two decades to get the industry to adopt the use of scientific algorithms. Unfortunately, that just hasn't happened. The industry is trying to move that way, but there's a lot of resistance from the industry because it removes the the perception that those doing the examinations have secret powers or secret abilities to be able to extract information from another individual. The science just does not support that notion. And so this is the next step in the evolution of the science. Again, there's no mandate that it be used. You know, I hope the legislature would trust those that are responsible for the oversight of community supervision to evaluate the technologies on their merits. If they don't work to the level of satisfaction, if there's issues with false positives, well then absolutely those professionals will not elect to use the tool. Conversely, if they are proven and determined to be useful to them as they supervise the community, they should be allowed to be used. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for Mr. Harris? Senator Lithicum?
Thank you, Mr. Harris. In terms of false positives that you were just referring to, it sounds, and the description we heard in earlier testimony, it sounds as though things like alcohol, drugs, maybe even cough medicine, who knows, would affect an individual's response time in some way and therefore possibly create false positives? Is that true?
Well, of course, if somebody is under the influence of drugs and alcohol, it would affect their response times. But response times are a very, very minimal element of our algorithm. We have other components of our algorithm that are far more heavily weighted. And at the front of every test, we have it's a very simple and clever test. We ask the examinee to look at the computer screen, and then we gradually remove light from the computer screen. If their eyes are not responding normally, because when you remove light from your eyes will dilate. If their eyes are not dilating properly, we know within the first 45 seconds of the test that they are chemically altered and that that the results of the test would be invalid.
This is a follow-up on a different line. I was under the impression that this methodology was best used for generic situations such as participating in bribery, a theft ring, money laundering, those kinds of real generic questions versus a specific line of questioning regarding an event. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. Because of the way our tests currently are devised, we can develop specific issue tests, but it's just a lot more labor intensive because we have to create the questions, we have to create the control questions, and we have to have them reviewed by our scientists. So where we tend to excel are in general screening applications. For example, in law enforcement, my understanding is there is no deception detection screening in law enforcement in Oregon. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. In most of the U.S., we have a test where we will ask some very basic questions about hard drug use, domestic violence, and if they have ever had any type of disciplinary action by a prior agency. Those are test questions that are very standardized across the U.S. And the control question that we use is terrorism, because it's highly, highly unlikely that someone applying to be a police officer is a terrorist. So we measure the differences in pupil dilation from the control questions and the questions that are sadly more common in our society. So that's an example. In the sex offender screening test, there are very common elements of restrictions that are given to sex offenders. Can't be around their victims, can't be around a school, can't view pornography, can't frequent areas of prostitution. So, and then the control questions that we use are questions related to using date rape drugs, because the statistics show that date rape drugs are used very, very infrequently, less than 5% of the time, in the commission of a sexual offense. So those are the types that now to go in and investigate, did you do this crime on this date at this time, is not the the best use of our technology. We would encourage law enforcement to continue to use polygraph for the investigation of a specific crime.
All right. Senator Manning.
Real quick, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I have two questions, sir. The first question is that did you have a team or consult with ophthalmologists when you actually did the design for this particular instrument? And the second part about that is that how does this vary from a person with 20/20 vision to a person that is highly astigmatism or has a very strong indication of astigmatism or other eye abnormalities or diseases?
Yeah, well, first on astigmatism, that has nothing to do with the ability of the pupil to dilate and not dilate. That's a curvature of the cornea. So the eyesight of the person has no impact on our test. In fact, we've been running studies in which we are getting very encouraging results where the people don't have to be able to read at all, or even look, they have to look at the screen so they can see the sensor, but if they're physically unable to read the words on the screen, either through their vision, we've still been able to get very good results, and we will be publishing those in the next 3 to 6 months. I'm sorry, I forgot the first part of your question, or consulting with ophthalmologists?
Correct.
We have a white paper that we can provide. We know that there are absolutely certain eye conditions that would make a subject they would not be a viable candidate for the use of our technology. They're few, but there are certain eye diseases. If you have We've seen a variety now that we've run tens of thousands of tests. The most common is somebody's had some trauma to the eye where the pupil is quote unquote blown. And what we do is we'll account for that in our software algorithms. Normally we take the dilation and constriction in both eyes and then we average the data. However, we have been able to scientifically calculate that there's very, very little difference in humans between the amount of dilation and constriction. The eyes work very, very well together. And so what we can do is if they have one good working eye, we can calculate an opinion on deception just using one data from one eye.
All right. Mr. Harris, I'm going to have, Senator Manning, did you have one other question or that's it?
I wasn't quite sure he answered the question whether or not.
Well, I think at this point we're going to go ahead and move forward with the other two people to testimony. We're not moving the bill today. As I said, this is a preview for what we might be doing in the interim. And so, Mr. Harris, I expect that we'll keep in contact with you and possibly we'll be able to arrange for you to visit here during the interim, and we can have a much broader and greater detailed analysis of the iDetect.
Great. I'm always happy to come back. I am an Oregonian, a native Oregonian, and my brother lives in Portland, so I'm always happy to come back. I just wasn't able to do so today.
I appreciate it. I know that this was a very short notice, as you well are aware of, but we wanted to at least get something on the record, so I appreciate you taking time out of your Tuesday to get us started. With that, I'm going to go ahead and ask the last two individuals I have scheduled to testify today, Jeremiah and Lucinda, why don't you two come forward? And Mr. Harris, you're more than willing to welcome to stay on the phone if you'd like to hear this testimony, or if you want to sign off, feel free to do so.
Sure, I'd be happy to stay on as long as I can.
All right, who wants to go first?
My name is Lucinda Heights Claybaugh, and I would ask you to first, before you do anything on this bill, that you would contact Peter Neufeld. He is one of the creators of the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School in New York, and he has served for many years until recently with a federal forensic assessment board. And I would ask that you ask him what he thinks about this technology before you would go forward. And also that you would call and contact Mark Godsey, G-O-D-S-E-Y, who is a former federal prosecutor, now the executive director of the Ohio Innocence Project at University of Cincinnati Law School. And ask him also what he thinks about this and confirmation bias, and then any of the actual research they might be aware of on this. As an educator for over 30 years, I used to want my kids to have the best learning possible in every situation, and so I use neuro-linguistic programming, which is a technique in learning for long-term memory, in which I had my kids take little cards and write a word on it or a phrase and then look up, and then you move your eyeballs and you are actually stimulating other parts of the brain for long-term memory. There are different parts of the brain which are activated, and I find this very interesting because when you have brain involvement in different parts of the brain, I know that at Harvard Medical School, years ago, researchers had really looked with MRIs and CAT scans and various other equipment to see what various things had been activated simultaneously. And even in Washington State, we have our own Dr. Daniel Amen, who has been on OPB many times talking about brain and love and brain and this and that, and how those things can be recorded. But there is a great deal we don't understand yet about what parts of the brain are involved. And I guess I would want to make sure that somebody in their research at one of these medical institutions had taken very ethical, moral, nonviolent people as part of their research and really looked at them with this kind of technology. So that there's extensive research, is there enough with results that would look on the spectrum of a person in deep meditation, for example, and what parts of the brain are being activated during deep meditation or prayer? What is activated during Kundalini yoga? When people are chanting and involved in Kundalini yoga and are changing their brain waves. During the traditional Catholic centering prayer process, Father Thomas Keating and monks have for centuries used a centering prayer technique, which is still used today by a number of people, including myself, as a spiritual practice. What is going on in what parts of the brain during this, and has that been recorded accurately with the results of that?
Lucinda, at this point, we're going to be taking more, detailed look at this, as you probably heard through our previous testimony. The bill is not moving forward today. I appreciate you putting some of these issues on the board. I'm going to ask you to summarize so I can get one other person testimony. I have a lot of work groups to do.
Well, I would also add PTSD sufferers, people at the VA in the VA Tapping Project, which uses Tibetan Qigong techniques, a spiritual healing technique, would also be an important piece of that VA hospital research, which is 96.8% helpful with VA PTSD users, but could a PTSD sufferer get a false positive with this? The other thing I want to mention is I myself have an eye condition, and I really appreciate Senator Manning's question, because I know that I have a condition with brightness factors and light factors in my visual field, which would prevent me from being able to get an accurate reading. And so I would ask people to use any deeper questioning as a part of this before it would ever go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeremiah.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections. You have my written testimony, and given the amount of testimony you've heard this morning, I'd like to summarize in three sentences. First, I'd like to thank Representative Hack for including the Department of Corrections since the inception of this bill in including us in looking at the applicability and whether or not we'd utilize the equipment. Second, to that issue, if this equipment were to be allowed, we would look to see whether or not it was a useful tool for us in community supervision. We don't know enough at this point. This morning's testimony has been helpful on that matter, but we still have work to do to determine whether or not we could use it. And third, if there is a work group, the Department of Corrections is happy to assist and participate as needed, Chair. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for these two individuals? Thank you all very much for coming forward. At this time, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2545B. And, Mr. Harris, I'm going to go ahead and sign you off, if that's all right.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your time. Have a wonderful day. All right. With that, we're going to stand down and take a recess for a moment. What we're going to do is figure out what we've come in on paperwork for our work session so we can get through what we have today, and then we'll be carrying over other matters. All right. We're going to come back in from recess, so we're back in order. What I'm going to do is just go through the work sessions and let everyone know, first of all, every bill that we do not hear today in the sense of a work session will be carried over until tomorrow, tomorrow being the 31st Wednesday of May. And so we will not be today carrying, or we will be carrying over, I should say, House Bill 2308A, House Bill 2597A, House Bill 2633A, House Bill 2740,
looks like two, so I'm going to say 2740. And House Bill 2988, House Bill 3047A, House Bill 3446A. Those I know for sure are being carried over until tomorrow. So with that, we're going to go ahead and start with what I believe is still in play on work sessions today, and we'll call a work session for House Bill 2360A.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2360A applies to prosecutions for failing to register as a sex offender and eliminates the obligation of the state to prove that the sex offender has obtained a new address. There is a dash A2 amendment on OLIS that sunsets this change on January 1, 2022. With the dash A2 amendments, House Bill 2360A has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, so we're looking for the A2s.
Chair, I move the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2360A.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash A2 amendments into House Bill 2360A. Discussion. Any objections? So order.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2360A as amended with the A2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2360A as amended by the A2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I support the bill as amended, but we did hear raised during the debate on this, or the public hearing on this bill, the problem of sex offenders who might be homeless and how to deal with that situation. I hope that's something we can look at during the interim, and if you'd like, I can be part of that.
All right. I appreciate your willingness to be part of it. I think it is something that we will continue to be working on to ensure that we can have compliance and also a rational basis for having individuals who are in temporary or lack housing are able to comply with whatever we require. So with that, any other discussion? Senator Manning.
Real quick, Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Dimbrough. I had met he was convicted of sex offense about 25 years ago, and he still can't get an apartment or any place else to live. He was able to get a little broken down trailer, you know, that he uses, but it is very difficult for many of them once they have been convicted of that to find a reasonable place to live. Thus, addresses may become virtually impossible. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other discussion? Any objections to the motion? Not seeing any, so ordered. Motion passes. And chair will carry 2360A to the floor. And we'll close that work session. We'll open up our next work session, which is on 2732A.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2732A provides civil and criminal immunity for a person who uses force to enter a motor vehicle to remove an unattended child or domestic animal that the person reasonably believes is in imminent danger of suffering harm. There is a dash A2 amendment that modifies the requirements for obtaining immunity. First, the amendment requires that the person contact law enforcement before or as soon as reasonably practicable after entering the motor vehicle. And second, while the A in Gross bill requires the person to remain on the scene with the child or animal in a safe location until law enforcement or emergency services arrive, the dash A2 amendment adds the owner or operator of the vehicle to this list so that the person must wait until at least one of these individuals arrives. With the dash A2 amendments, House Bill 2732 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2732A.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash A or the A2 into House Bill 2732A. Discussion?
I think it's helpful to have this amendment. I appreciate that that was added.
All right. Any other comments? All right. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2732A as amended with the A2 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves House Bill 2732A to the floor as amended by the A2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So order. I'm going to go out on a limb here and assign this to President Courtney. And President Courtney's not going to carry it. I'll be the honors. With that, we'll close the work session on 2732A, and we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2777.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2777 authorizes a mass transit district to establish an administrative process to adjudicate ordinance violations. The bill requires the mass transit district to stay the filing of the violation in court for 90 days while adjudicating the violation within 60 days. The citation may be filed in court if it is not successfully resolved through this administrative process or if, at any time, the person requests that it be filed in court. There is a -3 amendment posted on NOLIS that requires a mass transit district that establishes the administrative process to track data related to the citations, including the age, race, and sex of the person cited and the fine or community service imposed, and to submit a report based on this data to the judiciary committees. With the -3 amendment, House Bill 2777 has a minimal revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right.
All right. Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendments to House Bill 2777.
Senator Thatcher moves the -3 amendments into House Bill 2777. Discussion? Senator Dimbrough?
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that this is a modification of a proposal that we heard during the public hearing. You may remember that there was a proposal to include what's being required here, which is regular reporting by the transit district of the the results of this this new administrative process. They would be reporting on a regular basis. There was also a component that included creating a committee, you might remember, that was also included in statute. That was stripped out, and we have a letter of understanding from TriMet in this case indicating their commitment to a process like that. But I think we agreed during the public hearing that really it's best to keep that kind of specificity out of the statute. So that's what you have before you here.
All right. Any other comments or discussion? Any objection to the motion to adopt the -3s into 2777? Not seeing any, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2777 as amended with the -3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2777 as amended by the -3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Dimbrough will be the carrier, please, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2777, and we will open up a work session on House Bill 3242A.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski. Members of the committee, you previously heard House Bill 3242A on May 25th. It requires peace officers to record interviews of juveniles during interrogations for person felonies. There is a -A8 amendment, which expands this to all felonies, not just person felonies. And the -A8 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right. With that, we need the A8s.
Mr. Chair, I move the -A8 amendments to House Bill 3242A.
Senator Thatcher moves the A8 amendments into House Bill 3242A. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3242A as amended with the -A8s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 3242A as amended by the A8s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, discussion? Senator Thatcher.
I just want to make sure that if something goes wrong with it, I just want to make sure that it's not going to get kicked out simply because something went wrong with the recording equipment or they forgot part of it. I don't know. I just want to just clarify that this is not going to cause a conviction or a felony if they're proceeding with the charge to get kicked out because of an equipment failure.
All right. I'll first ask Council Perez to make her statements, and I'm going to follow up.
Yes, thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, Vice Chair Thatcher. That's correct. The provision does not allow, provide for suppression of the statements if they're not recorded. At most, what it does is give the court discretion to give a jury instruction that instructs basically the jury that recorded interviews are more reliable than somebody's rendition of what happened in a conversation. And then there are also exceptions to the recording requirement, and I'm trying to pull those up now. For instance, there's an exception if it's for a law enforcement agency that's five or fewer. Those officers do not have the recording requirement statements before the grand jury or statements in open court. So, no, it wouldn't result in suppression. But it might result in a jury instruction, depending on the circumstances.
Yeah. The only other thing I would say, even if you didn't get the jury instruction, I believe the other side, in this case, the defense, would be able to at least cross-examine the officer why that didn't happen, meaning why they didn't have a recording, and they could lay the issue before the jury for them to take that in consideration as to whether or not someone's veracity is has been impugned because it wasn't recorded.
And then if I just found the part I was looking for, it took me a second. There is also another exception that says if the state can demonstrate good cause for the failure to electronically record the interview. So in those situations, there might be a hearing before trial, and the state could say, we thought we were recording. It turns out we weren't. You know, that can be put before the judge.
And again, that could be some type of instruction from the jury or from the judge to the court, to the jury, as to equipment failure or unintended consequences or whatever.
Right, right.
Okay. All right. Any other comments? Any objection to the motion to adopt the A8s in the House Bill 3242A? Not seeing any. So ordered. Senator Thatcher?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill. Which one are we on? 3242A, as amended with the dash A8s, to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves House Bill 3242A, as amended by the A8s, to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Manning, would you be the carrier on this bill?
Yes, sir.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3242A. And we will open up a work session on House Bill 3380A.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3380A modifies the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program. The bill eliminates criminal history-based ineligibility for the program, provides eligibility for offenders who are pregnant at the time of sentencing, authorizes the court to impose a downward dispositional departure based on program eligibility, and directs the Department of Corrections to establish a process for selecting participating counties. There is a dash A6 amendment before you today that would make offenders charged with criminal mistreatment in the first degree eligible for the program. With the dash A6, House Bill 3380 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash A6 amendments to House Bill 3380A.
Senator Thatcher moves the dash 6 amendments into House Bill 3380A. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3380A. As amended with the dash 6 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 3380A as amended by the A6 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry 3380A to the floor. Close the work session on that bill, and we'll open up I believe our last work session for today, House Bill 3438A.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3438A requires the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to consider an inmate's eligibility for transitional housing and residential treatment programs in determining whether to waive the residency requirements applicable to the inmate's first 6 months of supervision. The bill provides that acceptance into a program constitutes good cause to waive the residency requirement and requires supervising agencies to include programs to which the inmate has been accepted in the inmate's release plan. There is a dash A6 amendment before you today that requires the Department of Corrections, in consultation with the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, to submit annual reports to the Judiciary Committee identifying the number of inmates considered for a residency waiver and the number who are granted a waiver. The amendment repeals this reporting requirement on February 1st, 2022, And with the Dash A6 amendments, House Bill 3438A has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash A6 amendment to House Bill 3438A.
Senator Thatcher moves the A6 amendment into House Bill 3438A. Discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I look forward to getting these reports to seeing how well this works out. I think it's a great idea.
All right. Other questions? All right. I do want to put on the record, and this is really for the benefit of the Department of Correction. We met some time back, and I told them that we would I would be working with the sponsor of the bill as to whether we needed to go forward with having a interim report. I had already talked to her about that being part of the process of moving forward. So when I talked to the Department of Corrections, I said I would see whether that was necessary. As you can see, it is necessary. So I appreciate you taking the time and willingness to be able to prepare the information for us to be able to get a report and realize or have a means of determining its effectiveness and what potential conflicts we could have with the different counties, if there are going to be any. But again, thank you very much. Any other comments or discussions? All right. Any objection to the A6 being taken into or adopted into 3438A? Not seeing so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3438A as amended with the Dash A6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 3438A as amended by the A6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. So is anyone wanting to carry this bill to the floor? All right. Senator Denborough will be the carrier on House Bill 3438A. And we'll close the work session on that bill. And as I stated, for all the other bills that I've already gone through, if I have not caught one of those, or even if I said it before, everything else that's on today's agenda is carried over until tomorrow, Wednesday, May 31st, for work sessions, with the exception of the bill that we had the public hearing on, which was House Bill 2545B. That's all we were scheduled to do, in the sense that that's what we put on the record, that we would not have a work session, but everything else under work sessions will be carried over till tomorrow unless they were taken care of today. With that, we're adjourned, and I think tomorrow we'll hear back at 8:15. With that, thank you very much. Thank you very much. We'll hear back at 8:15.